My husband Don and I live in a condo in Cedar Rapids that borders on a lovely little lake. Now, our granddaughter Gabby would contest the idea that you would actually call it a lake because she thinks that's too small to be called a lake. But, you know, in response, we would say, well, there's all kinds of signs around her that call it a lake, and we have a lake association board, and the street leading up to the water is called Lakeview Drive. But, you know, that's not really the point. The point is that this little body of water in our backyard is quite lovely, you know? We have fountains that are lit up at night, and we have a walkway that goes around the entire perimeter, although our bridge was blown away 2 years ago with a derecho. It's not yet been replaced, but still, we have the lovely benches where you can sit and just relax and enjoy the scene, you know, and there are flowering bushes, there are sculptures all along the way, you know, there are places for people to fish. And when you're inside our condo and you want to look out through the window, the scene, I think, is very peaceful and serene. In other words, it's just really quite lovely. But there are some times, especially in the summer when it's been really hot and we haven't gotten hardly any rain, that the water in our little lake can turn all stagnant and green. And when water turns stagnant and green, it can smell really bad, right? And it can use, you know, start growing algae, and that can use up all of the oxygen and all of the nutrients. And when that happens, it's really not lovely at all. And honestly, I don't think anyone in our homeowners association really likes to live with a stagnant lake right in our backyard. Back in Old Testament times, when the children of Israel were traveling with Moses through the wilderness, they didn't want to camp by stagnant water. And so what they would do when they were looking for a place to camp is they would search out streams of flowing water, rivers of water, or places where there would be springs. And when they found these, they called them living waters, both because the water was moving and looked like it maybe was alive, but because they knew that in order to live, they needed good, fresh, clean water. They needed it to drink themselves. They needed it for their animals to drink. And they knew that in the desert like that, it wasn't just automatically assured that you would necessarily come up on a stream of fresh, clean water. And so when they did, they considered it a gift from God. And they praised God. They thanked God for it. And also they began to associate water to be even a symbol of God's goodness and grace. And it was out there in that desert, in that wilderness, that the Jewish people began to actually incorporate water into some of their religious rituals as a way to help them worship. So, for example, Moses' brother Aaron was the very first high priest, the one to officiate at offerings and sacrifices. And always, before starting a sacrifice, he would make sure that there was a copper bowl filled with fresh water that he would sit right next to the altar. And then any time before he would actually officiate at a sacrifice, he would ceremonially wash his hands in that water so that he could be symbolically pure and prepared to stand before a holy God. And before too long, this idea of purifying waters trickled down to all the people. So that in the morning when anyone woke up, one of the first things they would do would be to ritually wash their hands in water. And they, you know, they pour the water first in their right hand and then their left, and they do it two or maybe three times. And while they did it, they would give thanks to the Lord for the gift of a new day and for the gift of new life. And sometimes people would even be suffering from some kind of illness or disease, or they would for some reason have become estranged from the community, and then they wouldn't just wash their hands, they would immerse themselves in pools of this fresh water as a way to obtain healing and cleansing and re-entrance back into the community. And when they did that, they were not going to dip themselves into or wash their hands in stagnant water, because if you did that, that's going to have the opposite effect of healing and cleansing. I know that from experience, because many years ago, my husband and I decided that we were going to go tubing down the Apple River in Wisconsin. And it was a lovely summer day, and we were just, you know, happily floating along in the water, when all of a sudden we came to this stretch of the river that was covered from bank to bank. All of the water had these big blooms of algae, and the current was going, and we couldn't get out of it. There was no way to avoid not just floating right through that algae, so that's what we did. And for more than 2 weeks afterwards, I had this terrible skin rash and oozing blisters. It's not something that I would recommend. But you know, it's not just water that can become stagnant. In our lives, our faith can become stagnant too. We can find that we're doing religious things and it just leaves us feeling empty. We don't feel like we're moving anywhere. We don't feel like we're getting anywhere. Our relationship with God seems murky. We don't feel like serving. We can't see any benefit to reading the Bible or praying. You know, when we get together with other religious people, it feels more like an irritant than a blessing. It's not a good place to be. But did you know that Jesus himself sometimes felt like that? That's the background to the story that we heard today from John. Jesus was in the third year of his ministry, and frankly, things were not going well. The religious leaders were constantly harassing him. They were criticizing him, condemning him, even plotting ways that they could kill him. And then on the other hand, there were the Jews that really wanted to take over and kick out the Roman rulers, and they wanted Jesus to lead their insurrection, and they wanted to force him to be their king. And then Jesus had just fed more than 5,000 people with just a little bit of fish and bread. And instead of the people learning from that experience that they could trust God to provide for their needs, you know what they wanted and what they demanded from Jesus? They said, "What we want is free food every day. Give it to us." And when Jesus wouldn't work miracles for them, and you know, that didn't go over very well. And especially when Jesus said to them, "What you really need to hunger and thirst for is my body and my blood," they couldn't swallow that. That seemed disgusting to them. And so many, many, many people that had been following Jesus decided then and there that they'd had enough of that. And they turned around and started abandoning Jesus. They didn't want to go around with him anymore. And even some of Jesus' closest followers said, "No, this is not for us anymore." And they left him. And Jesus wound up feeling really discouraged, really despondent, like, my ministry is going nowhere. And he went to his closest 12 disciples and he asked them, "Are you going to leave me too?" And when Peter responded, "Well, Lord, if we did, where would we go?" That wasn't much consolation to Jesus. And so Jesus decided then and there to call it quits. He decided that his traveling ministry had just come to an end, and he wasn't going to do it anymore. And he was just going to go back home. He was going to leave Jerusalem and Judea, and he's just going to go back up north to Galilee, and he's just going to hide out at home. And that's what he did. So he's there at home, hiding out at home, feeling despondent. And his own brothers, who had never been fully supportive of his ministry in the first place, were concerned about him. They said to him, "Jesus, why are you hiding out here? This isn't like you. You know that the festival of booths is just about to start in Jerusalem, and you know good and well that you are expected to be there. So get a move on. Get up. Get out there, you know, go to Jerusalem, work some miracles, gain back your followers, you know, you'll become famous." And Jesus said, "That's all good and well for you to say. My situation is not the same as yours. You're not going to go there and have people want to kill you. I'm not going." And you see, the thing that Jesus knew about this festival of booths, This autumn harvest festival that we sometimes call the Festival of Sukkot, he knew that what it really had turned out to be by now was just the biggest, most raucous party that the Jewish people had in a given year. He knew that thousands, millions even, of Jews from all around the world would congregate in Jerusalem for an entire week, and that the very first thing that they would do when they got there is they'd erect these temporary open-air booths so they'd have a place to meet with their families and friends, and then they would just party for the entire week. And on the first night of the festival, the religious authorities would go to the Temple Mount where there were four 75-foot-high candelabra standing right outside the temple, and they would light these candelabra, and since the Temple Mount is on the highest position in the city of Jerusalem, these four candelabra just served like floodlights that just shone over the entire city of Jerusalem all night long, every night for the entire week. And because all of this wonderful nighttime light created the perfect ambiance for middle of the night revelry, that's what happened. So what you would have is you would have these normally very sedate elders with their long flowing beards, singing at the top of their lungs, dancing. And you would find this normally very reserved rabbi turning cartwheels, performing acrobatics, juggling fiery torches. It wasn't anything except fun until dawn came. And right at the crack of dawn, the partying would stop for just a little while. And everyone would reverently make a long line between the temple all the way outside of the city. And the priests would process outside the city, through the gates. They would go outside where there was this spring called the Pool of Siloam. And they would carry this golden flask with them. And they would very ceremoniously dip up a flask full of water in this golden pitcher. And then, accompanied by the fanfare of trumpets, they would process back into the city, back through the water gate to the temple, up to the altar area itself. And they didn't pour this water into the copper bowl because this water had come straight directly from the source. So they just poured it directly onto the altar. And when they did that, there was a moment of silence. And everyone prayed, asking God to please send them rain so that next year's harvest could be good. And then after that moment of silence, the partying began again. And this year Jesus just didn't feel like partying. And he knew that by this time, this water drawing ceremony no longer really meant anything spiritual to the people. It just meant an opportunity for them to ask God to give them a good life so they could have a good life and party, a year from now. So Jesus just didn't want to go. And he didn't go at first. But when the ceremony was about halfway over, for some reason he changed his mind. And he decided to go, but he went incognito. He just kept in the background for most of the time. But on the very last morning of the ceremony, he joined those thousands, maybe even millions of other people standing up to observe the water drawing ceremony. And as he stood there, I think Jesus realized, everything about this festival points to me. Those temporary booths, the bright lights shining from the candelabra, the water that's being poured out on the altar, the animals being sacrificed on the altar, all of this points to me, because he was God come down to live temporarily in a human home. He was the light of the world. He was the living water. He would be the one who would have to die. And he knew that people needed to know this. So in the middle of this very, very solemn ceremony, Jesus stood up and he just began to shout. And what he shouted was, "Anyone who is thirsty, come to me and drink. Anyone who believes in me, come and have a drink. Because scriptures say, rivers of living water will flow from the heart of those who believe in me." Now, when Jesus issued that invitation, did anyone accept it? Did anyone admit their thirst and say, "We want a drink"? Actually, some did, but there were only a few. The priests certainly didn't. They were outraged at the way Jesus had interrupted their ceremony. They were so angry, they ordered the temple guards to arrest him. But the temple guards were among the people who actually acknowledged their thirst. So they didn't do it. They didn't arrest Jesus. And when the religious authorities asked them, "Why not?" they said, "Because the words that this man spoke made us think." And especially when the Pharisees heard that, boy, they were irate. And they were actually terribly rude to those guards. They said to them, "You are just plain stupid. You're just ignorant. There isn't a single person that has any sense at all in the entire city that would believe what this man says." And as a result of this, as a result of Jesus standing up and giving out this invitation, it would eventually cost Jesus his life. He would wind up drinking a cup of suffering he didn't really want to drink. He would wind up being crucified and dying with this terrible thirst. And he would just pour out everything so that we could live. But the invitation still stands. And Jesus still says, "Anyone who is thirsty, come to me. Come directly to the source and drink deeply. And when you do, rivers of living water will flow out from your hearts out into the world." You see, I think Jesus understood something very important about water. Let's say you have a body of water. Maybe it's in your backyard, maybe it's anywhere. And let's say that it rains, or let's say it's the end of winter and snow drifts are beginning to melt and all that water goes into the lake. If there is no outlet for that water, it's going to turn stagnant within 6 days. That's not very long at all. But the same thing can happen in our own lives. You see, when God wants to pour out his grace upon us, he doesn't want us just to be receptacles of his grace. Although he does invite each one of us personally to drink from him, and he will fill us up with his grace. But what he really wants us to be is fountains of his goodness, conduits of his love. He wants us to be rivers of living water that will flow out into the world. Because if we don't, what will happen in our hearts is our hearts will become breeding grounds for things that are not lovely at all. Breeding grounds for things that are ugly, like injustice and intolerance and prejudice and lies, you know, and division and hatred. Things that cause people out there to look at the church and say, "If that's what's happening there, then I'm not going." Why would they want to go and be with people that have that coming out of them any more than Jesus would want to go to the festival of booths? But you know what? At our homeowners association, nobody wants to live with their backyard filled with stagnant water. So at the first sign that water is starting to turn green, that Lake Association Board, they get busy. They meet. They decide what they need to do to aerate the water, to get the water moving. They do something about it. And I think that's what Jesus calls us to do too. Yes, there are going to become times in our lives when we just feel stagnant. But Jesus is saying, you can do something about it. You can come to the source. You can drink deeply. And you don't have to bring a bucket to the well. You don't have to bring a golden flask. You just need to bring an open heart that never closes down. An open heart that stays open so that all of the love and grace of God that flows into you can flow out into the world. And so may it be.